Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome back, Cracked fans, to another edition of the Cracked Interviews podcast. I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. It has been far too long since we talked any college tennis on our Cracked Rackets platform. Now, of course, when the season got canceled due to the emergence of the coronavirus pandemic, that threw a lot of our plans off. It threw plans off for all of us across the globe. But it feels really good for me to say today that we are getting back to our college tennis roots, chatting a little bit today about the college tennis world. And no person I would rather do that with than my co-host, Chris Halioris, who joins me on today's interview, where we talk to Tennessee men's tennis head coach Chris Woodruff. And for those of you who don't know Coach Woodruff's background, and if you're a fan of tennis who was born before the 90s, you certainly remember his name. He's a guy who had success himself as a college tennis player. He was the 1993 NCAA men's singles champion at Tennessee, went on to a pro career that saw him rank inside the top 30 of the ATP singles rankings. He, of course, the highlights of his career include winning the 1997 Canada Masters event, as well as making the quarterfinals of the Australian Open in 2000. But, you know, Coach Woodruff's been involved with the Tennessee program for the majority of his life. He joined the team as an assistant coach in the summer of 2002, was the assistant through 2017, when he took over the head coach's job. And he's done a phenomenal job. You talk about the players who have filtered through that program over that course of time. Guys like Tennis Sandgren, who's been top 100 in singles. J.P. Smith, who's had such a phenomenal doubles career. Ryan Williams, one of the most talented Americans to filter through the system over the past, you know, certainly in the 21st century, was as talented as they come. Davey Sandgren as well. I mean, Mikhail Labidus, Hunter Reese. The list could go on and on and on. So Chris and I got the chance to talk with Coach Woodruff actually this morning about his time at Tennessee, how the coronavirus impacted his team. Was he able to get all of his players home? What's it going to look like for them when they come back, recruiting wise, scholarship wise, the extra year of eligibility? Of course, some of that is still up in the air, but we talked to Coach Woodruff about that, about his recruiting philosophies, about, you know, some of his time, some of the matches he has coached, such as that sequence last year when they beat Florida in the SEC Conference semifinals, only to match up with them again in the round of 16. And anyone who watched those matches last year knows just how exciting they were. We, of course, also had a lot of fun with Coach Woodruff. So with that in mind, enjoy our conversation with Tennessee men's tennis head coach Chris Woodruff.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Joining us now on the Cracked Interviews podcast, a man who has had success in every avenue of tennis he's explored. He has a career high in singles of number 29 and was the 1997 Canada Masters champion. He was also a former NCAA singles champion, winning a title with the Tennessee Volunteers in 1993. And it's only fitting that he is now back there as the men's tennis head coach. Coach Chris Woodruff, welcome to the Cracked Interviews podcast. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, guys. Thanks a lot for having me on your show.
Oh, it is our pleasure, believe me. And I made this joke before we started, but it's rare that I'm outnumbered in terms of the Chris's we have. Chris Halioris also on the phone for today's podcast. I guess, other Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Finally, I'm glad to get back to talking about some, college tennis and tennis in general.
I could not agree with you more. I know we are all missing it more now than ever. And unfortunately, I think that is the place we have to start with you, Coach Woodruff. In terms of, you know, this last month, we saw play get canceled for this 2020 season. How has this past month been for your program? How did your guys react to that news? And, you know, what are you guys doing now to stay close?
Well, we were actually getting ready to play South Carolina and really get into the meat of our season with South Carolina on the road and Florida on the road and then two other schools. So I don't think any of us really knew what to expect. We took a bus down to Columbia from Knoxville and we were following the news and started seeing all these things being canceled. And as time got closer and closer to the match, then I saw the SEC talked to Coach Barnes, and then the SEC basketball tournament got canceled. We kind of figured that we were going to be turning around and coming home, and then the lasting effect of this for myself and the guys on the team, we have a group chat, and we've been sending messages through the group chat and just trying to tell them when they plan on returning and what's been voted on and what's passed and what's on the table. So I think it's really a time of anxiety for all of us as there are way more important things than the SEC tennis schedule.
No, certainly. I mean, it's a tricky time for all of us, and I know it's still a little bit up in the air, but with the NCAA, I think, voting next week on that extra year of eligibility for all of the players who had their senior seasons robbed or just this year robbed in general. I don't know if you have any particular insight into that. You know when that vote's going to play, how you think it's going to go, but I'm curious, what are your thoughts on this idea of granting those seniors an extra year of eligibility?
Well, selfishly, I think it'd be great. I'd like to have my... My guys back, obviously, and the thing that I am a little concerned about to your question is, for us, they vote on it and it passes. Well, what happens if college football doesn't pop? You know, what happens if in April or when they start, we have empty stadiums? Then that's gonna change the landscape of college, or at least what I do. I think drastically. Really, kind of in the back of my mind, I'm kind of thinking probably more about that than whether they're going to vote and say it's okay to bring all my guys back. But for us, Bill James and myself, we'd love to have our team back from last year.
Yeah, I mean, Coach, that's got to make the planning just the planning aspects a little difficult. I mean, I think you only had Luca as a senior, is that right?
Well, we had Giles Hussey as well.
Oh, as a grad transfer, yeah. So, I mean, from a planning perspective, you're looking at it and A, you got to know, you know, can they even come back? And then I guess B is if they can, you know, depending on, and, you know, I don't know your situation, but depending on how much scholarship money you had tied up in the guys, right, and what they're going to do with scholarship limits, right? I mean, I can't believe that it would just be unlimited, that, you know, you just get whatever you had, you get to bring them back on top of your 4.5. They could do that. I don't see that happening. But so all of those variables kind of have to almost just put you in limbo in terms of figuring out what the heck you can do for the year until you get all those answers, doesn't it?
You're exactly right. And, you know, who would cover it? Is it going to be just the institution? And then I'll give you just a smaller problem, if you will. You know, the SEC has a rule so let's say we get our seniors back, right? And now all of a sudden the seniors come and the freshmen come, and I've gone from a roster of 9 guys up to 12 guys, right? Well, the SEC has a rule you can only travel 8.
Yep.
So we really only, I'm going to leave four guys at home. You know, the women are allowed to travel 10. And so one of the moves that we're talking about in our conference is, it's something that needs to be addressed, obviously, is taking 10 on the road. So now instead of leaving, you know, 4 guys, I can maybe leave 2 or 1 or one of the guys behind. So there are a whole lot of things that are going to factor into this once it's decided, especially for our conference.
No, without question.
And I will tell you, you know, yesterday it was voted in our conference that we're going to replay the 2020 schedule. So for the SEC, we'll start up March 6th next year. We'll go back to Georgia. So we are going to repeat the schedule that was on the docket for this year, 2020. We're going to repeat it for 2021.
I know. That's really interesting. And, you know, even things like the ITA kickoff draft, right? How can you have another kickoff weekend without a full season of results? All of those things are up in the air. I'm also curious, how has it affected your recruiting? Because it's not like there are tennis tournaments for you to go out and watch. And I know you have your class for next season already locked in. But for the subsequent years, I imagine this has not been easy from a recruiting standpoint.
You're exactly right. Fortunately, we've had to get on the phone and talk to a player or two and tell them kind of just hold on. You know, it's an uneasy time for us, and it's also an uneasy time for the player, because we had a couple of guys that were really interested in coming here, and now I don't know, and now he doesn't know what's happening. So we were moving along nicely, and maybe, you know, things were headed in a positive direction, and with what's happened, it's all kind of been put on hold. And, you know, to your point, April 15th, it you know, shut down at least till April 15th, and kind of treating this, obviously, we've been told, as a dead period.
Yeah,
I was going to say, I've got, I guess, one more follow-up on that. So we talk kind of a lot about this year's impact, but, right, if there, I mean, the talk has been that everybody is going to get basically, the red shirt year for the year, which means, you know, freshmen are effectively freshmen again, right? And so that's got it. That impacts, and you know, I look at some of the downstream impact to that, and if that's the case, right, it kind of thins over the next 4 years. You have like a total of one less class basically to recruit. So all these kids, and I look at all these people that talk about how, and I've never been a proponent of this, but they talk about how the American kids don't get as many of the scholarships and we have so many international players. And that's just a function of, you know, talent and population of people that play tennis, right? But it's going to thin that out even more, because there's going to be just, you know, a year's less, a fewer number of openings to be had with, you know, assuming the number of players that actually exercise the chance to play 5 years, right? Obviously not everybody will, but I would think that's going to have impacts on you, really, not just now, but over the course of the next couple of years, just because of the, you know, in all likelihood, the fewer number of players needed, given that some, you'll have some come back.
You're exactly right, and I've heard that talked about, and you bring up a great point. That's just another issue that we're going to have to work through, and how are they going to handle it? So, I mean, I really have no idea what is going to happen. And then, as you guys discussed earlier in regards to Monday, I know the NCAA Council's meeting in the afternoon. What they decide, that could flip again. You know, like I said, if football doesn't run, that could flip again. So it's kind of hard to have to really get a plan for what we're doing. I've told my guys, you know, like we were talking about earlier, I've told my guys when I'd like to have them back, because they've gone home. And they've spent more time at home probably now, and will get more time at home than they ever have. And so all I can really do is control the things that I feel I can control, and that is kind of set a temporary start date of when I want our guys back. Once this passes, we can reach back out to recruits and kind of get that rolling in the right direction. But you're exactly right. There are just a lot of problems and uncertainties, like you just mentioned.
Were all your guys able to successfully get home, like specifically say Luca and Prada, with being in areas that I think probably had, like, you know, 2 week quarantines if they tried to go home, for example? Like, I know some of the Mississippi State guys, just, I know they haven't gone home, and I know from Trevor, some of the Liberty guys that were going back to Portugal haven't left yet because of that.
I think there was some real concern. Like, you know, Pat Harper obviously lives in Australia, and he got home and he texted me and said he made it, and he had, you know, quarantine for 14 days. But, you know, the other thing to consider is these parents. I think, you know, I had a couple of my guys whose parents were legitimately getting concerned and talking to them over the phone about, you know, almost to the point, I think, of tears, some of them, that, you know, we really need you to come home. And here we are sitting, well, is the country going to shut down? You heard maybe the airports and all of what was happening. But, yes, to answer your question, all of my guys, Prado in Portugal, he got home. Everybody's home. And now the question becomes, can they get back?
Right.
Who knows, right? Can they get back? Can they not? I mean, that was one of the things that we talked about, and it was brought up in our meetings, is this happened during spring, you know, shortly thereafter spring break. So guys went to spring break, had to come home from Florida, and then had meetings in our league and at our institution. And, you know, if these guys go home, make it very clear that we can't help them get back. They could get to these countries and get stuck. That's a whole another thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, it's definitely a scary time. And again, we appreciate you coming on to the podcast to discuss these things because we know how much of this is still in the air. I do want to pivot now to some more enjoyable stuff because I know when the season got canceled, you guys were in the midst of a really good run. You were 14-2 on the season. You lost only to Columbia that kickoff weekend, and then Georgia. Obviously, you guys were coming off of a year where in the SEC tournament, you made the finals as well and made the round of 16. Things are looking very good for your program, aren't they, Coach Woodruff?
Well, I've got a really good staff. James is, you know, my assistant. We've got a great strength and conditioning guy. And so I have a really good group of people around me who probably do a lot more of the work than I do. The one thing that I'll say about our team is, yes, I think we were trending in the right direction. And especially if you look at the history of what we've done, we always try to peak down the stretch. You know, if you look at several years, last year, to your point, we were peaking at the right time. And we I want to say we started slow, but, you know, Columbia, obviously very good, tough, hard-nosed team. And as we all know, Athens is a tough place to play. Looking forward to going back there again, at least I hope. But we were trending in the right direction, and we're starting to get our doubles lineup kind of solidified. I find it very tough to get the doubles going, but we were trending in the right direction like the previous year, yes.
Without question. And, you know, for you now, I believe you took over as the head coach at the end of the 2017 season or maybe the start of the 2017 season. But, you know, for you, do you feel now your team, you know, how are you feeling? It's your third year in the job. Are you feeling comfortable? All things rocking and rolling?
You know, I'm trying to get better every year. Every year I feel that my staff and I, we kind of sit down at year's end and figure out what we can and what worked and what didn't work. And I was actually on a walk with our basketball coach here this morning, you know, Coach Barnes, and we were talking about how the game's changed and what he's learned from technology. And there's also a certain amount of that we both agreed about, you know, just going with your gut. So, you know, James and I, we make a lot of decisions based on our gut and kind of what we're feeling. And I feel we're trending in the right direction and hopefully we get some of these recruits that are on the blocks and the future looks very promising for the Tennessee Volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, obviously playing in the SEC is, I mean, one of, you know, arguably what, you know, one of the best, you know, conferences out there. You've got so many good, I mean, you're going to have, seems like every year you've got at least two or three top 10 teams in the SEC, and you guys are always right there challenging to be one of those teams. I mean, how much of a difference does it make, you know, all the way around for the player development, the fact just recruiting, et cetera, being in the SEC?
Well, I think I was listening to your podcast, what was it, a few weeks ago, and I think you guys were counting up. We were heading or gravitating towards, what you guys count up, nine teams were maybe on the, we're going to get into the NCAA tournament. Was it eight or nine? I think you guys went through it and maybe nine, it might have been 10. I can't remember the exact number. So, you know, that says a lot. And the thing about our league is we talk about the Georgias and the Floridas and the A&Ms, but, you know, there are a lot of teams down below from top to bottom. Everybody can play in our conference. You know, even if you're at the very bottom, you're still pretty good. You might have gotten what I say roughed up in our league, if you will. But it's a pound for pound. It's a good fighting league, and like you said, it's competitive. And athletic directors, they want to win, and it really does matter in our conference. And like you said, it's a marketable brand. It's something you can go out and you can talk to recruits about, and you can say, hey, we play in the SEC. you can get them, and then you can show them some of the players that have come through our you know, conference and gone on to have good careers, and it just means a lot.
I would have introduced you as a longtime listener, first-time caller, Coach. I didn't know you were a listener.
Well, I can't say I'm a regular listener, but that just worked out really well for me that I heard your cast last time or two, and you were talking about how many, the same thing, basically, the depth of our conference and how many you thought we were going to get in, and I think you guys were right. We were going to get a lot in.
Yeah, I think for the folks that don't pay maybe too close attention, I think, you know, if you ask up and down the SEC, and I'm not trying to pick on Auburn here, but Auburn was clearly going to be, you know, the bottom marker in the SEC. But yet, if you look at the rankings, the first couple computer rankings that come out, and that's solely based on who you've played and who you've beaten, they were actually ranked. They were hovering between like 45 and 50 for a couple rankings, and they were going to be, you know, team number 13. So that's
right,
just,
right.
You know, that's how good the SEC, you know, top to bottom is.
That's right. And the thing about it is, it seems to always be like that, doesn't it? I've been a part of this, you know, growing up in Knoxville. I've been a part of this league, and I've followed the great Tennessee teams. And I can remember when Tennessee in the 90s and 80s, when they, you know, had Anacone and Mike DePalmer Jr. and some really good players coming through, that even the bottom league teams would come in and push the really good ball teams. So it's been perpetual, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's always like that.
Yeah, no, it's a testament to the strength of the conference. I mean, you know, the appeal of playing outdoor tennis all year long for tennis players is obvious as well. And I'm curious for you because, as you mentioned, you've been part of the Tennessee program for a long time. You joined as an assistant all the way back in the summer of 2002. And obviously you're an NCAA singles champion as well. I'm curious, how helpful is that for you from a coaching standpoint, just to show the guys, you know, I'm sure your name is on the wall. Does that help you connect with them? And as you're going through adverse situations, you'd say, hey, I was there. I've been through it all as well.
Well, you know, I don't know. I've kind of passed their, you know, past their generation. You know, they're probably not as familiar with the Agassiz and the Sampras as, you know, they follow the Nadals and the Murrays and those guys. So, whether they know about my career or not is one thing. I just think that I have, values that I try to implement and instill when they come here. And you got to love the game of tennis, and you got to be tough. We talk about being tough-minded, trying to run a fair program. And, you know, if you can't, I don't expect a 10 every day, but if all you can give me is a 7, then we need to get the 7 out of you. We're not going to get don't let that 7 turn into a 6 or 5. So I just more or less follow my heart and kind of rely on not so much my playing career, but knowing the things that worked well for me. And if I'm honest with you, that's just good old fashioned hard work. Have
no
idea of the strokes or anything like that. But so we just kind of dig it out of the dirt here, if you will.
No, I love hearing that. And I know one of my favorite sequence of matches last year was, as we mentioned earlier, at the end of the season when you guys went to Gainesville. You knocked off Florida in the SEC tournament, excuse me. And you could tell from the body language that meant so much to your program. And, you know, you got the chance to line up with them again in the round of 16. They got you guys there. But can you talk about that sequence of matches? Because I imagine, you know, watching on a PlaySite stream, that looked about as intense as any match I've seen in college tennis over the past couple of years. And, you know, as you look back on those matches last season, I imagine you have fonder memories about one of the matches than the other. But can you talk a little bit about those two matches?
I mean, both of them were. I think the first match was kind of a heavyweight going up against a welterweight. I've had to really work on my guys' heads, making sure that they believe that we could get in there. So if you looked at what we were playing with, I was playing with a transfer from Eastern Illinois who was 250 in the country. I was playing with a walk-on at the bottom of the lineup, you know, and, you know, going up against guys who were, I think, semifinals of Kalamazoo and top 20 ITF in the world. So that's what I'm talking about with, you know, they were more the heavyweights and we were kind of a welterweight that got into that heavyweight weight class actually during the match, if that makes sense. You could just see the surge of belief come across my guys. And you know, that was kind of how it went round one. And then if you want to call it round, you know, fight number two, it was very similar. And like you said, if you were following that match, my guy down there at five, Preston Juliotis, he had match points and double faulted. Then all of a sudden we get that match, and then Timo Stoddard's playing the decider. I think Timo was ahead when the match had stopped. Can't remember whether he was ahead or wasn't. So we were trending again. But win or lose, I mean, it was a great atmosphere, great crowd, fair crowd. They were loving it, and you know my guys were loving it as well. It was the quintessential college tennis match.
Yeah, I was there, Alex, for the first one, obviously in the SEC tournament, and that was, you know, it was just everything about it was, you know, the match was dark, the lights were on at the, you know, for the finish of the match, and you had, you know, I think those last two on, if I remember, were Waltz against Riffis and Luca against against Andrade those stands, I'll tell you, you know, coming from the Mississippi State side where we were waiting to play the winner, you look at those stands and you're like, man, this is a big crowd. You know, it's not going to be easy playing in front of them. And yeah, they come out well down there, and it was loud. It was a tough atmosphere. I think, like Coach Woodruff said, there wasn't anything unfair about it. They were a good crowd, but they packed the stands for that match, and it was you know, coming down to those last two matches, that was a great match.
Agree.
No, for sure. And you know, when you have a win like that as a program to get back to a conference tournament final and knock off a top five school like Florida, I think they might have been ranked even higher at the time. Do you think you guys have ridden, you know, the momentum since that moment? Did that instill a sense of belief in your guys?
I think the latter of what you just said is right on. I you're always, you know, it's easy for a coach to stand up in front of a group of kids and give a rah-rah speech and you know, and then you lose, and then you go out and you give another rah-rah speech. And at what point the player starts to think, well, this coach is, he really doesn't know what he's talking about. So it really, if anything, it validated all the things. It was a culmination of all the hard work that I used to preach to the guy James and I would preach to the guys last year. And it's nice to be able to have something to hang your hat on, right? That's something that's tangible. You can live it, breathe it, see it, feel it. Very important. You got to feel what that's like to be in that, you know, kind of that man in the arena, if you will. So it was really good. Whether we got momentum from it going forward, I don't know. It was just something. Now it's easy to look back and say, hey, guys, look, you remember when we did this? And now what they have is an experience. And I think it's very important to have experiences. That was always something that I tried to get, you know, instill in myself is, now what can I do? I've played on center court before, so now I can use that to play on this center court. You know what I'm saying, guys? It's about that experience and that feeling. And I think for those non-believers on the team, what that win did was, now all of a sudden, by gosh, they believe, baby, they believe they can do it. And that was huge.
No, it was an incredible match, certainly. And just, it was great. You know, when college tennis is good, it's as good as any product out there from the tennis world.
That's right. And the thing is, it's trying to get those fans out there and trying to get to sync up the times. And when can people get off work? It's tough to get off work on a Friday at 4 or a, you know, Sunday at 1. And especially being in the South, I know, you know, with church and stuff, it's tough to get the fans out there at 1 o'clock on a Sunday.
Yeah. Hey, Coach, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, and I don't want to get into the details why, but now that we're getting an extra year back, is there, you know, you started the year with a couple guys that aren't on the roster now. Is there any chance at all that we see either Scotty Jones back, who obviously was a lineup starter for you, and then I think Finn Stoddard as well wasn't listed at the end of the year on the roster. You know, so are both of those guys, you know, gone for good, or is there a chance we might see either of them coming back?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, we since January, four guys four guys have left, right? I mean, we were playing, you know, just had to make some decisions, and we did what we did, and those guys had a good understanding of why, and it was a good parting on each way. And as I can't really, I don't know what the future holds. Obviously, with Finn, he'll figure it out. He's a good kid, lefty. I think he brings an awful lot to the table. Scotty Jones is getting his degree, and actually probably will meet with him in a couple of weeks and see what he's thinking and doing. But we're just rolling along. And then, like you said, you know, Scotty's finishing up, and we're just trying to get everything situated going forward.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to talk about your background because, again, I think you're as qualified as any college coach out there. You've had an amazing playing career yourself, but in terms of your program moving forward, obviously there's a lot of uncertainty around all of college tennis, but how are you feeling about the state of Tennessee men's tennis?
Well, I think we're always trying to, you know, forward thinking, always trying to just tweak certain things here and there. Fortunately, since after year one, James and I have kind of been working within that model. We had to make several changes after the first year. But since then, it's just been little tweaks here and there. And we just had a meeting the other day trying to get our schedule set for the fall of what we want to try to accomplish. A very few changes, but those few changes can often, you know, over time, really blossom into bigger changes. But I feel really good about and James has done such a great job, and he's brought so much passion and energy. I really got to give a lot of credit to him. I just, like I tell the guys, and I just kind of, you know, little changes with the boat here and there just kind of keep us on course, and he's really the one behind the scenes doing a lot of the hard work.
James is my guy, and James knows I love him. But I have to ask you, Coach, name one assistant coach that takes things harder than James does.
Well, you know, I don't really know because, like you guys said, I've been here since 2002, so I haven't had a lot of experiences. He definitely likes to win. I'll say that he's very competitive, and he he's very passionate about what he does. But you know, I've tried to talk to him. You know. Great guy to model is, as you guys know probably, or read, is, or you guys are students of the game, I'm sure, is Federer. The quicker you can get over something like he does, the better you're going to be, and you're going to, what I talk to him about is prolonging your career. We can't take losses as hard as he does and expect to be in this business 20 years, especially if you're going to coach in the SEC, because the guys who last are the guys who can move by, get over things. This league will spit you up and, you know, chew you out.
Yeah, you're going to take
your
chew
you up and spit you out. Sorry, chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah.
No, I mean, certainly if you want to have a full head of hair over the next 10 years, you got to get over things quickly, right?
Yeah, you do in this conference because it's so competitive. And then the minute you lose your competitive spirit in this conference, it's time to find another occupation or go somewhere else. This conference does a very good job of letting you know when it's time to depart.
No, without question. I mean, you look at all the success you have had throughout your time there. You've gotten, I think, three guys to the number one rankings in singles. I think it's five teams up to that number one ranking in doubles. Singles finalists in Ryan Williams, JP Smith. Doubles champions in Libidis and Reese. And then, of course, a couple finals as well. Does it help when you're on the recruiting trail, even beyond your own personal success, to be able to point to those guys right away and say, hey, you know, these individuals are, I think Hunter's right around the top 100, if he's not top 100 in doubles right now. And, you know, Tennis Sandgren, obviously, going on to the success he's had on the ATP tour. Is it easier to point to those guys' success, your own success, you know, is when you're making pitches to recruits?
I think, you know, like you're saying there, just combining it all. But you know, what I really try to do more than point to what I've done or what JP Smith or Tennis Sandgren has done is really try to find a system guy, the guy that I feel is going to fit our system. And like I said earlier, you just got to love tennis because we, like a lot of other schools, we work hard and we expect a lot. And so really trying to find a system guy, yeah, the results speak for themselves. It's nice to pull out the program, and it's nice to kind of hang your hat on the development of the players that have come through here and that I've had a hand, along with many other people, been able to go on and play pro. But really looking for guys who fit what we're trying to do at the University of Tennessee, which really is to get better, you know, on a daily basis. Of course we want to win. Of course we want to win the league and the NCAAs, but it's hard to see that if you don't really focus on the day-to-day challenge of getting better. And that's really what I look for in the recruits. Who wants to come in at the University of Tennessee and get better on a daily basis and go through the ups and downs? So I'm not always going to, you know, just make your life. You got to get uncomfortable being uncomfortable, really.
Yes, you talk about some of those recruits, and one of the questions I know I wanted to ask is, I think you guys have a streak of it. I don't know how many years it is, but it's a long number of years of at least one Australian kid on the team. Did Sam start? Where did that start? And, you know, do you just have is it just an area of focus for you guys, or do you have, you know, kind of a niche, you have an in, so to speak, in kind of an area or a club or you know, some folks over there that kind of help in that aspect, and they happen and they've turned them into a bunch of Tennessee fans? But how do you keep such a streak like that going?
A pipeline?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, to answer your question, I think it's since 1986 that we've had an Australian come here. And it's just, you know, they're a nation of great sport. They're a nation of, they love tennis. And it started a while ago that the head coach prior to Sam was from Australia. And then the head coach after that one was Australian. So he just really continued on that tradition. The guy who took over after, you know, was Mike DePalmer and then John Chris and then Michael Fancutt. Michael Fancutt was he came here in the 80s to play. So that's kind of how it happened. And it's evolved ever since. And I have some connections. I played with a few Australians that were on the team and word of mouth. And I've flown over for their champ showcase in December to watch them. So it's just one thing led to another, and we have a good connection, and there have been some really good ones.
I'm glad they don't hold any resentment for you knocking off Philippoussis in that 97 Canada Masters.
Yeah, that was the quarters in Canada, right?
Yeah, it was. I played some really good Australians along the way.
No question about that. And I do want to talk about your playing career, because you grew up in Tennessee. You obviously were an incredible player yourself, and you elected to go play 2 years at Tennessee. What is it about the state, the program, that, you know, kept you drawn in and ultimately has you still there now, you know, 27 years later?
It was really serendipity, right? I wasn't looking for it. I stopped playing, and my home was in Knoxville, and ironically enough, my roommate, when Michael Fancutt left, Chris Monty took over the job, who's now heavily involved with Tennis Australia. He took over the job and asked me if, you know, I wanted to be his assistant. But prior to that, Michael Fancutt, who also played at the University of Tennessee, asked me if I wanted to be the volunteer assistant. And that's where it all started. And one thing led to another. And I just happened to play, you know, a small hand when I was the volunteer. I was still playing at a high level and come out and play with the guys. And that led to me hanging around the program more. And they had a really good team. That was when they were making, you know, the Final Fours and things like that. And Chris asked if I'd hang around a little longer. And he went to work for Tennis Australia. And it's really, the rest is history. I was able to finish my degree while I was the assistant coach, which was a lot of work. I was going to school full time and trying to help Chris, and just kind of never look back.
So is that where, I mean, I know you had a singles title back when you played there, but I know one of the things since I've been watching, you know, the Vols play at, you know, under your direction, the doubles have been just, I mean, that's always been a strong point is the Tennessee doubles, right? So Was that was that one of your strong suits back then? Is that a really strong focus of yours for the team?
It always has been. I know that when Michael Fancutt and Chris were here, they worked on doubles, and you know those Australians they have a history of being really good at doubles, don't they? So they kind of instilled that program, the doubles program, and then I played. It was 2 out of 3 sets, so you had time to get into your rhythm a little bit when I was in college, and then I went to the 8 game, and now we're playing 6. So you got to be pretty skilled. I feel it's not as much skill as it used to be. It's a lot more about the energy and a lot more about, you know, who can get hot for 20 minutes, right? It only takes 20 minutes. But, yes, we work on doubles every single day that we have practice. And we're always trying to watch film, watch a lot of film on the doubles, always looking for ways to improve. But it's hard to improve if you're only playing for 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah. All right, so I got to ask. You and Makai versus your one doubles, who wins? And have you played?
Well, I guess the long and short of that is we I'm not sold that we ever found a one doubles team this year being a quarter of the way. Well, James is a much better tennis player than I am. I rarely hit. I've gotten really locked into the coaching part. But I would say that if I could practice, if you give me a few months, I like our chances.
Yeah.
I like our chances of playing anywhere in the conference, really.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. And, you know, you go on to be a top 30 singles player. You did take 2 years of college tennis. I'm curious, how did that college tennis help prepare you for your pro career? And given the scoring format changes, as you mentioned, some college tennis happens so fast now. Would you still recommend college tennis as a pathway for those who have pro career aspirations?
If it's done the right way, yes. And you can find coach that you trust, yes. One of the things for me was that college instilled that competitive drive. It gave me a taste of a level that was up from what I was playing in the juniors. So I really wanted to get a little bit more of the taste of what it was like to move on from a competitive spirit and really honing my skills and seeing what I could do and pushing myself. And college tennis really helped me get into a routine. It helped me learn about some, although it wasn't as popular probably as it is now, of eating right and taking care of my body and learning about recovery and really just opened my eyes to, wow, there's just a lot more than getting in your car and showing up to the club to practice and then going home and doing, you know, what else. I really loved all that recovery and loved the training and loved the stretching, and I loved doing the conditioning, and I loved hitting tennis balls. I just absolutely loved it. It was a passion of mine, and so to be able to prolong that, and really what happened for me was I just felt like college tennis, I couldn't improve anymore, right? I won the NCAAs and this and that, and I played on, so you know, 1 year played on a good team, and I played one, and I just felt like, okay, I'd maximized my area of improvement. And so I felt that was a pretty prudent way to go about it, right? If you feel that you're done learning, and I felt like the ball speed was also something that I noticed when I would hit with people that were better than me who were playing pro at the time, the ball speed was different than what I was seeing. So I just felt there were many facets, but the main one being I felt that I couldn't improve anymore. It was time to try, and what a wonderful opportunity that life could go on and I could do something that I had an incredible passion for.
So you talked about the quick doubles and the format that used to be there when you were playing at Tennessee. What do you think about, you know, the scoring formats we have now? Are you do you like the no ad scoring? Do you like the shortened doubles? Do you like the, you know, not playing, you know, or playing the lets, not having the lets, you know, all of the above? Where do you stand on all of that?
I think as a coach, it's tough. The no ad is tough. personally, for me, the set, it's, I understand what they were doing for the fans. I think it was, you know, a fan-based decision, and it's probably good that that it doesn't take. I can remember some of our dual matches would take 5 hours, right? You'd go out and you'd play all the singles matches, and then you'd come back and you'd play two out of three set doubles matches. So imagine how that would look if you had only three or four indoor courts, or if it rained, or even on matches that would go the distance. You'd play 5-6 hours, right? I don't know if you guys remember that, but you know, it would take forever. As it's kind of changed the way I coach the doubles. Like I said earlier, probably a little less skill, and you got to teach a little more about emotion, understanding momentum swings, the ebbs and flows of matches. But no ad, it kind of, in certain ways, I feel like it's tied my hands a little bit with strategy. Deuce add, the longer something goes on, the more your eyes can see it, the more you can implement it, and the more it'll take effect over time. So it definitely, with the shortened format, I've had to adjust as a coach.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned there some of the, you know, some of the indoors, the number of courts. So one of my takes that I would love to see implemented, and I'd love to get your stance, is all of these schools now, because, and let's be honest, we may not be a huge fan sport, but there are things being done for the sake of the fans, like trying to shorten match times, right? You know, we want to have people come out and watch. And to that end, my stance is anybody building new courts should have to build six wide. None of these four court facilities or split three and three. I want to be able to see all six courts at the same time. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's great. And another thing that they did when we played the college showcase down there against Duke, or they were talking about doing, we played the singles, you know, play the singles first. They wanted to play the singles first. They felt it was a better product if you put the singles out there first. So there are many ways to go about doing it. But yes, there's no question. When I first started, that was one of the things that was a killer. We had four indoor courts, right? We finally got two added on. But, I mean, sometimes the five and six men, how do you recruit that? How do I say to the guys, hey, you can come here. You're probably going to be our, you know, five or six guy, or you're going to play here in the lineup, but you may not get in the dual match.
And when you do, you're probably going to get set in. Yeah.
Right. The five. Right. Exactly. The five and six guys would sit up there and get all ready to go in a full sweat. We'd watch them running on the treadmill or exercise bike, and then all the match is over, or it means nothing. Very tough, but you're right. Six courts. You got to have – the other thing that drives me crazy is if we go to a school and they have no indoors. How do you not have indoor – how do you not have indoor courts? Like, we were gonna face that problem in Columbia, you know, and I was talking to Josh about it. They have no indoor courts. Imagine the stress that Josh is under constantly to be looking at the weather. Probably looks at the weather 2 weeks out. We were going to move the match up with 4 or 5 hours because there was a 30%, 40% chance of rain. What can you do? No indoor courts. Incredible.
Yeah, and they used to have that. I guess that was five years ago now, for my guys' freshman years. I remember they had that four-court indoor facility that we ended up having to move to for the SEC tournament and play till midnight the 1 year. But then I guess
I love that building, by the way. I thought that building was awesome. It was just old school, blue collar, just right in the middle of the track. One side was the track and the other side was the football.
It was a great spot.
True field house, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The definition of a field house.
I think they gave it to track and field.
Right. They did. They did. I saw it when we went down there. I made sure I went up. I just looked at it. You know, it just was old school wooden doors. Everybody, all the coaches' locker rooms were in there, volleyball. It was just old school. I loved it.
Yeah.
No, without question. And I'm curious, because to get back to the scoring for the NOAD and the sped up format and just, you know, trying to make the product more, I guess, marketable for fans, do you think it's increased the parity that we see in college tennis?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah, I'd say you're probably right. I'd say you're probably right. It has.
And is that? Do you think that's a net good thing, a bad thing for the sport? What are your feelings on that?
To have some parity.
Yeah.
Are you asking whether that's a? Yeah, I think if you're one of those teams that's doing well, like we were talking about earlier, you know, if you're struggling at the bottom of the conference and saying there's great parity, I think that parity can lead to some problems. But if you're up there at the top and consistently at the top and you're always looking to be pushed and challenged, it's great. If you're down at the bottom and there's strong parity and you're fighting out for 10, 11, 12, and, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, I think it could be tough and wear on you, right?
No, without question. And I think from a fan perspective, that's half, you know, it gets fun. You see so many 4-3 matches and thrillers and, you know, everyone's rushing the court now for every circumstance. So I certainly am entertained.
From an ability standpoint, for the parity that you're talking about, when I was not involved with the program and I was just a kid growing up in Knoxville and I was following the Tennessee tennis, but I was also following SEC sports, and you could see the parity that was in the sports at the time, I would come out and I would watch Tennessee. Let's say at the time, maybe like a Mississippi State wasn't as good as Tennessee, right? Or a Kentucky. I'd come out just because of the name Mississippi State or Kentucky and watch that match because I knew the SEC was tough, right? And there was a lot of equality in that league.
Yeah. No, without question. Completely agree with you there. And again, I want to be conscious of your time. You've been so kind to us. I have to ask, because one of my favorite teams, and, you know, I was born 95, just to date you guys a little bit. You know, you had already won an NCAA singles title before I was even born. One of my favorite teams growing up was that Tennessee team with J.P. Smith, Ryan Williams, Tennis Sandgren. You guys made that run to the final. Is that the best Tennessee team in history? Because I just remember watching that team and being, I mean, you see all the pro success they had, but what was it like to coach that team? How special was it?
Well, you know, it's like I tell people, we had two guys at the bottom. We had a guy top 10 in the country, right, who actually probably top 8 in the country who didn't even play in the finals. Who against USC didn't play. We had, in fact, two guys on that team who were playing 5 and 6 and sometimes not even playing, who were both top 10. That's pretty impressive, right? We had a guy who came to college at 600 in the world. We had, you know, Ryan Williams and Tennis Sandgren, who were obviously world-ranked juniors, right? J.P. Smith, top 10 ITF in the world. I don't know whether it was the greatest team in history. Now, we were trending. Had J.P. singles career, you know, kept going. At one point, I think he got to 105. Ryan Williams, I think, got to around 110. Tennis Sandgren is what he is now. I mean, had those guys all been in the top 100 and all still have been playing like tennis is now, that'd be tough to refute. Maybe one of the greatest teams ever. But you know what? The bottom line is we didn't win a national title with that team. And that's a heartbreaker. That's really what I remember. You know, hats off to Peter and Steve and Robert and those guys. They had a great team. But that's what I remember, unfortunately, is we didn't win at all. And we won the doubles point.
No, definitely. And I'm curious, do you think the level of college tennis, the depth that's required to make strides and win big matches, big events, do you think the depth has improved since that time? Because I've pointed to those USC teams, the Virginia teams that followed, and, you know, you look at just the amount of pro players they had lining the roster. You guys were obviously in a similar scenario. Do you think the level of men's college tennis has continued to improve over the years?
I think it's like the ATP Tour. I think it goes up and down. The one thing that I can say that's pretty accurate, if you can play one in the SEC, consistently play one and do well, I think you have a shot at playing pro tennis. I think that, for me, that's the one thing that I've been in this league a long time. I've watched this league before I got involved in it from a, you know, just a fan perspective, you know, like you. You watch it from a fan perspective, and I'm sure you've seen trends that have happened, but that's probably the one thing that stood out. If you play one in this conference, you've got a shot at going on and at least putting yourself in an okay position. I don't want to say good, but okay position to make it as a pro. And by make it, I mean you're making money, and that's what you call your primary craft.
Yeah. No, without question. I've only got one more question for you, and it's pro-related, so I have to, because I have you here, in terms of your pro career, two wins I want to point to in specific. 96 French Open, five-set win over Andre Agassi. I also want to point to that 2000 Australian Open where you made the quarterfinals, and by the way, that's freaking awesome. Congratulations to you. Five sets over Tim Henman. Which do you look back on more fondly?
Well, I think if I'm honest, not to talk about my career or anything, but the Davis Cup win in the fifth rubber was pretty special. That was something that I probably remember more than beating Andre, and I remember more making it, you know, to the quarterfinals. So I guess that was something that I really remember. And then the thing that I like to also remind myself of is that I was a pretty good player and I beat seven world number ones. Not a lot of people can say that. You know, you beat all seven world number ones. I'm pretty proud of that. But the Davis Cup, since I had gone to college, I loved it. You know, just like John Isner, you hear him talk about, you know, how much, and you watch, you've actually watched John well, so I can talk about him. You actually have heard John talk about how much he loves Davis Cup and how much he loves the team environment. And that was kind of the way I was. I was fortunate enough to play on two Davis Cup teams, one that won, one that didn't. But like you said, I also remember playing Andre. He was a legend of the game and you know, one of the few that I believe intended our sport, right? You had Borg and Connors and McEnroe, and then you had Andre, unbelievable, and a great person as well. Just to play on court Suzanne Lang in a Grand Slam event was something, you know, something really special as well.
You're telling me, let's say, and I'm just going to use his name arbitrarily, but like Adam Walton's mouthing off to you, and you're not like, Adam, I beat Andre. Like, just relax, Adam.
No, but I'll put the foot down and I'll say something like, Adam, stop doing that. I know what I'm talking about. So, you know, I'm kind of, you know, it's kind of like at arm's length, you know, don't mess with me here on this one. I know what I'm, you got a problem, shut up. You know, I don't say shut up to my players, but you know, they'll be first to tell you that I can be pretty tough on them. I expect a lot. Now, don't get me wrong.
No, justifiably so, Coach. And again, we are so grateful for the opportunity to have the chance to chat with you. And, you know, we wish you luck. We hope you and your players stay safe. And, you know, thank you. You know, the seat is always open should you want to come back on this podcast.
You know, I got to say that you guys do a great job. I listen to your cast, you know, sometimes, like I said earlier. But it's really admirable. And it's, you guys are great innovators and you show such passion and you know, just college tennis and it's really great what you do. So both you two keep doing what you're doing, and like you said, if you ever want me back or I can help out, you know, I'll be glad to do it in any way I possibly can.
Really appreciate you saying that. It's because there's another Chris on the pod, right? You Chris's stick together.
we definitely appreciate it, Coach, and that's what, you know, Alex and I privately we'll talk. We love to hear that, right? We love what we're doing, but it's also great that you guys love just what we're doing and the coverage that we're bringing. So anytime we hear that, it just keeps us going. It makes sure we stay doing it. So thank
you. You keep doing what you're doing, and I'll get a go balls in there.
I love it. Yeah. From now on, I'll keep that in mind that you might be listening. No more trash talk. But Coach Woodruff, thank you so much. And again, stay safe. And hopefully we'll get to see some more college tennis soon.
Yeah, you got it, guys. Keep it up.
Yeah,
great to be with you.
Great to talk to you, Coach. Take care. Hope you enjoyed our conversation with Tennessee men's tennis head coach Chris Woodruff, and again, a huge shout out to him for taking the time to chat with us. We hope he, his players, his program, all everyone around, I mean,
of course, the Tennessee program stays safe and healthy throughout these trying times, and can't thank him enough for taking the time to talk about some of the implications of the coronavirus on his college tennis program, because I know that's something college tennis fans across the globe continue to think about. It's not just these interviews, though. We have kept things rocking and rolling here at Cracked Rackets, trying to keep as much content heading your way as possible. If we can provide you even a momentary distraction from the stresses all of us are feeling right now in our day-to-day lives, then we will continue to be doing our job. And look, if you need distractions, here's the piece of content I want you guys to go check out right now. Go to YouTube.com. Type in Cracked Rackets in the search bar and watch our second episode of Overserved. We are really happy with the way our new video series that pokes fun at all of the unintentional comedy from the tennis world on a day-by-day, week-by-week basis has turned out. Super producer Daniel Westhoff continues to kill it. He's made me look funny, and you all know how hard that is. You hear a lot of my bad jokes throughout the podcast. He's cut out all the bad jokes, and we are really happy with the way that turned out. Skits, and, you know, we talk about Christiane's TikToks, what she's been doing, and we try our own version of that. There's dancing, there's rapping, which just makes me cringe even if I say it, but I promise it is pretty funny. Max Rothman makes a return to drop a little bit of beatboxing. We poke light at, you know, Roland Garros making their move and kind of upending the 2020 schedule, but it's a really fun series, so be sure to go check that out, and since you're there, you might as well subscribe, right? It's two extra clicks. Come on. As soon as we get to 1,000 subscribers, I will stop asking you to do this, but I know there's 1,000 of you out there who certainly will enjoy this content, so be sure to go check that out. It would mean the world to super producer Daniel Westhoff. Of course, we've also got all things firing on our mini break podcast as well. We never want to leave you guys without some sort of content on a day-by-day basis. This week, we've talked Technique Tuesday. Jamie and I did a little bit of ranking. We also talked Elena Rybakina on today's mini break podcast, as well as a book, a match, and a piece of content for you from Wednesday, just to continue to give you guys options to turn to in case you're like me and you just need some sort of fix of tennis in your life. We've also got a lot of really fun projects underway here at Cracked Rackets, a series we're calling CR Classics. Should be heading your way in the next few days. Not going to give away what it is, but I know it's something you all will enjoy. I can promise you that. We've also got some other really fun stuff under works that I'm not going to quite give away, but if you've listened to our other podcasts, you know, you may have an idea of what it's about. I'll say this, it's in the college tennis realm, so I am still getting my college tennis fix, regardless of the fact that there is no season moving forward in 2020. That being said, before we wrap up, have to give a shout out, as always, to the super producers, Max Fligner and Daniel Westhoff, for the of an editing job they do day in, day out. It doesn't happen without their incredible work behind the scenes, so shout out to those guys. But for our wonderful guest today, Tennessee men's hat. Let's try that again. Westhoff, give me a rewind sound effect, please. For our wonderful guest, Tennessee men's tennis head coach Chris Woodruff. For my wonderful co-host, College Tennis Ranks, Chris Halioris, and for our super producers, Max Fligner and Daniel Westhoff, and from all of us here at Cracked Rackets, I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. That's today's Cracked Interviews podcast, folks, and we will see you next time. Thanks, everyone.